Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This episode, retired anthropologist and dean Phyllis Morrow discusses serving all people through knowledge.
The rural campuses have done something that Alaska struggled with for a very, very long time, which is to make higher education available to people who live in remote communities. That's gone through so many iterations with the community college campuses, which then became colleges in their own right, have this unique ability to be physically located closer to the remote communities and to be responsive to local needs and to tailor programs for people in those areas that you just can't do from a more distant site.
And on Catexa Clippings, Chris Lott tackles contemporary culture's 3Ds.
As Christopher Hitchens was said to have said, though I've had no luck tracking down the source, how dismal it is to see present-day Americans yearning for the very orthodoxy that their country was founded to escape.
I hope you'll stick around. This summer on Northern Soundings, I'm running a series of recorded conversations with retired University of Alaska Fairbanks scholars, researchers, and leaders. Our discussions take place live Monday nights at the Murry Auditorium on the UAF campus in a series called Down Memory Lane. The series is hosted by UAF Summer Sessions, and my thanks to it for permission to air these conversations. This week, I talk with anthropologist and former UAF dean Phyllis Morrow. Phyllis served in the YK region for years, teaching Yupik culture and language, but her work also extended to sharing with those in the legal system how to understand the nuances of Alaska Native cultures. It's work that she and her husband Chase continue as consultants. When Phyllis shifted to UAF, she helped start the Women's Study Program and worked to elevate the importance of equality in the workplace and school. Later, she helmed the College of Liberal Arts. Phyllis did her graduate work at Harvard and went on to graduate studies at Cornell, where she received her master's and PhD in cultural anthropology. I began our discussion by asking if she was attracted to Harvard because of a program or professor.
Colleges are just a mystery. I see students who are looking at colleges, and you don't go because there's a particular professor. You don't know about that idea. I wasn't planning to go to Harvard. I wasn't planning to apply to Harvard. I had a list of schools I was applying to, and my father said, well, you should apply to Harvard. And I said, I'm not, what? He said, you should apply to Harvard. And I said, well, I don't think I'll get in. And he said, well, you won't know if you don't apply. So that's why I applied to Harvard.
Higher education was important in your family.
Yeah, well, my father had a bachelor's degree. He was an engineer by training. My mother had a high school degree, but they were very literate. They were funny. They read all the time. They argued about, my father said there were three topics that you shouldn't discuss at dinner: politics, religion, and sex. And so it was very important to discuss all of them as much as we could, and with a group of really interesting friends that they had who were from all kinds of disciplines. Education was important, and I grew up in a town where there had been an influx of scientists. It was Aberdeen, Maryland, and the Aberdeen Proving Ground, which is the testing facility for the U.S. Army, was there, and that was contiguous to the Edgewood Arsenal, which was where chemical weapons were developed. But the place was full of scientists and mathematicians, and they were from a lot of different places. So there were many smart people around.
Well, that's kind of segues to my next question. You know, you went into cultural anthropology. Were there a broad range of cultures available? It sounds like with these scientists, maybe so.
There were scientists from different places. I mean, most notoriously, it turned out later that Aberdeen Proving Ground had former Nazi scientists that came in. Pratcliffe was kind of a notorious chapter there. There was a lot of hidden history. But there were scientists from all over the place. And, you know, we had some friends who were mostly from European countries, Russia, Czechoslovakia, places
like that. Mm-hmm. So you're exposed to it. When did the light come on then for you, Phyllis, when you thought to yourself, cultural anthropology, I like that?
I didn't know the term cultural anthropology, but I was always, as long as I can remember, I was interested in different cultures. And I had a favorite series of children's books that I must have been very young because I remember the texture as much as the content, but they were about people in different parts of the world. And one of them was about people in the far north, and one of them was about ancient Egyptians. And I have a strong memory of wondering how people could live in such very different environments and different circumstances. You know, there would be people slaving over a hot pyramid and people living in, you know, cold climate housing.
Yeah, old school cold climate housing. Yeah.
Very efficient old school cold climate housing.
So you went on to Harvard. Tell me what cultural anthropology was like when you were studying it as an undergraduate in your first years in graduate school.
It was interesting because anthropology went through very big changes during that period. I mean, when I first entered anthropology, it was just barely beginning to question the colonialist history of anthropology. Most things that were written from a very kind of distant authorial viewpoint. There were theories about cross-cultural contact were mostly based on the idea of assimilation, that people assimilated to an incoming culture or and this isn't just in cultural anthropology. I mean, anthropology in general has multiple subdisciplines, but that whole paradigm was beginning to shift and be questioned. The whole concept of culture, over the time that I studied anthropology, the whole concept of culture was questioned in a different way. The idea of different voices writing ethnography became more, it was more acceptable to write in the first person and to write experientially and instead of sort of standing back and taking a distant observer's perspective. Studies of folklore, for example, were beginning to take into account the whole idea of context and performance, who you're telling us, not the text as something that you study separate from its telling, but the telling in its social context and how that the meaning of the stories are relevant and shaped by the storyteller for the audience and understood by the audience in terms of their own experiences. Those kinds of things were developing, and that was very influential for me.
You know, hearing you talk, it strikes me, it's so interesting that you enjoy acting, because there is a cultural example for our historical Western society, where very much the context is where you're telling it. It's not just the text, even though we tend to study it as text. It's a live performance that really conveys the power of the piece.
I think that's true. I had my first fieldwork experience when I was in college. In the summer of my junior year, with very little preparation, I went off to Jamaica, and I was interested in Chinese. Okay, so...
Wow.
Okay. I was studying Chinese. I was interested in Chinese anthropology. At the time, you couldn't go to China. Americans couldn't travel to China. So my professors, in their infinite wisdom, said, yes, but there are overseas Chinese communities in other places. So actually, there's a student here that you might meet who is Jamaican Chinese. And maybe you should go to Jamaica, because 10 years ago somebody did a study on the Chinese in Jamaica, and nothing's been done in 10 years, so you could go do that. And I met this other student, and he was lovely, and he introduced me to his family, and they said, okay, she can stay with us. I mean, this is amazing to me now. The generosity, well, it was amazing to me then too. The generosity was incredible. And that was my first experience of imposing on somebody and saying, can I learn about you? Can I ask you about a bunch of questions? Can I meet people that you know and you know, use your connections to find out about you and your lives and what you think of the world? So I did that, and then I had to write a senior thesis. And I struggled with that because the paradigm in anthropology didn't fit my experience. The ideas about assimilation didn't match what I saw there. And it's really interesting rereading that piece of work now, because I can feel those tensions. I can see how I was like being a good girl and doing what I was supposed to be doing, but how it wasn't working and I was trying and struggling to say something different but didn't have the vocabulary for it. And it was great because anthropology shifted and there was more vocabulary and there were more people who were thinking in different ways as time went on.
Were there women mentors for you? Of course, Margaret Mead is the big name we think of in anthropology. Were there figures at Harvard or Cornell that you kind of...
One of the nice things about a Harvard education is that from, I think, your sophomore year, you get assigned to an individual faculty member to have a one-on-one tutorial. And I was matched up with Cora Dubois. And Cora Dubois was a Margaret Mead type figure in anthropology, and she was wonderful. She was a great role model. And there was also, you know, there was this feeling that anthropology was something that women, strong women, were in anthropology. It was okay to go into that field and you could do professional work. So she was a great role model.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with anthropologist and former UAF Dean Phyllis Morrow. When we return from the break, discovering the North. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week I'm speaking with anthropologist and former dean Phyllis Morrow. Let's get back to the conversation.
At some point between your master's and your doctorate, your eyes were directed north and you came up to Alaska.
I went to Cornell because it had a strong Asian studies program. But by that time, I was waffling about wanting to go to China, even though China was now open, right? I could have gone to China, but I somehow was less interested in it. And I got to Cornell, and in my first year, another student in my class came up to me and she said, she was an archaeologist, she said, there's this archaeological site in Alaska, and it's got this really interesting burial. It's a human burial. It's at Point Hope, Iputak period, and buried with this person is a loon with ivory eyes with jet inlaid pupils. And she said, "You're interested in folklore and symbolic anthropology and those kinds of things. I can't figure out what that might mean. What do you think?" And I'm like, "I don't know, but it sounds really amazing." And she handed me this monograph by Frohlich Rainey, and I started looking through it, and it had 10,000 artifacts, these beautiful ivory carvings and chains made out of ivory, and I mean, fabulous, fabulous stuff, and I was utterly fascinated, and there was this loon with the inset ivory eyes. And so I got quite interested in it, and I said, "Well, let's find out about loons in northern folklore." And so we looked about, you know, I started doing that research, and I started finding things about connections with vision, and I thought, well, maybe that's a clue, a vision and shamanism and all of this. And we got really excited about this, and we wrote a paper together. And one day when we were in the card catalog, that was back when there were card catalogs, and I looked up at her and I said, "We ought to go to Alaska." And she said, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah, how about this summer?" And she's like, "Okay." So
Simpler days.
Really simpler days, because we then threw in a couple of, we published the article in the Journal of American Folklore, which was very cool. And we applied for a grant from the Arctic Institute of North America. And naively, I, in that grant, made sure, you know, I knew that we were going to run into bears, so we needed to have a rifle. I'd never shot a rifle. And we needed winter weight sleeping bags for the summer. And all kinds of things like that. But somebody at the Arctic Institute of North America said, sure, give these young students a chance to go to Alaska. They have some ideas. So we got the money to come to Alaska. And that was in days when things were really well supported here, because we then got in contact with folks at the University of Alaska. John Cook was here. We tried to find people who were doing cultural anthropology. Toby was interested in archaeology. I was interested in cultural anthropology. And I thought, you know, I might even want to find some place to work in Alaska. So we tried to find cultural anthropologists. They were few and far between. Linda Alana was here, and she hosted us. And that came into the story, and we'll get me to Bethel in a second. So we came up. We didn't have a rifle. We had our sleeping bags, and we had a tent. And we contacted John Cook and said, is there any archaeology going on? You know, we would do that. We would do anything. We just want to meet people. We want to know what anthropology is going on. And they said yes, and we arrived. And they paid us. We came home with more money than our grant had sent us up with. We went up to the North Slope. We did archaeology there, and we got paid for that. And then we went down to Kachemak Bay and did some archaeology there. I'd never done archaeology. I'd never been on a dig, so that was great for me. And I wanted to be someplace where with contemporary people. So we met Linda Ilana. She hosted us in Anchorage. And she said, you ought to go to Sleet Mute. She said, I run a field school out in Sleet Mute. I've been out there for many years. It's on the Kuskokwim. And you know, there are people there who know me, and it would be fine if you went out for a visit. And so we were like, okay, we'll go there for a week. And we hitched a ride on a small plane to Sleet Mute. And we got weathered there, so we were there for more than 2 weeks. And I was utterly in love with Alaska, and I wanted to go back to the Kuskokwim area. And that's how that happened.
And so was Pat O'Rourke then at that campus when you went to Bethel?
So that, I barely passed through Bethel on that trip. Hmm. When I came back to Alaska, which was some years later, I came back, I developed a potential research project, I applied for funding for that. I met that guy in the striped shirt up there. We decided to get married. I was sure NSF didn't have any money that year. It was a bad year for NSF, so I was like, okay, I'm not going to get funded. We decided to get married. A packet arrived in the mail, and I said, oh, how nice. NSF returned my application form, and inside it said, you got the grant. And so I looked at him and said, you want to move to Alaska for a while? And he said, sure. So we headed back, and but we wanted to study Yupik before we went. And that was the point when I contacted Pat O'Rourke, and there wasn't any place to study Yupik. We were like, there must be materials, there must be something out here. So we found the little sleuthing and help from, I think, Larry, I don't know if you were in on that, or we talked to Mike Krause or somebody, but somehow secondhand, third-handed, we found out about somebody that was a linguist who had a bootleg copy of the Yupik grammar, which had not yet been published. He was no longer an active linguist. He was busking as a musician in Boston. But we found him, and we got a bootleg copy of the bootleg copy of the Yupik grammar. And we sat down with that and started studying it on our own. And that we couldn't pronounce anything. We had no models for pronunciation, but we could learn something about the grammar. And then we went out to Seattle, which was a little bit closer to Alaska, and put an advertisement in the newspaper saying that we wanted to learn Yupik. And was there a Yupik tutor available? And the newspaper wouldn't print it because Yupik tutor meant that we were looking for a Yupik person, which was not, we couldn't specify an ethnicity. which was kind of funny. So we said a Yupik speaking tutor, and that was fine. And that turned up Fanny Ayagalaria, who was living with her husband, Russ Slayton, Fanny Slayton, in the Seattle area. And she was not literate in Yupik, but she spoke Yupik. So we had a nice mutual relationship. We could figure out how to write in Yupik from what we had in front of us, and she knew how to speak it. So she could, we could help her with what the spelling was trying to indicate, and she could actually say it. And so we had, she was our tutor. And then we came up to Fairbanks and jumped into Steve Jacobson's second semester Yupik class.
I'm assuming learning language, especially if the people you're interacting with and studying and learning from, is pretty critical. Do languages come easily for you?
I like languages. I'm not a Larry Kaplan. I like language study a lot. I studied French through high school. I don't know, does it come easily? I like studying languages.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm airing a recording of a public conversation I had with former UAF Dean Phyllis Morrow. Phyllis has worked to help the legal profession better grasp Alaska Native ways. When we return from the break, navigating among cultures. Listening to Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This episode, I'm airing my conversation with anthropologist and dean emerita Phyllis Morrow. Let's get back to the conversation.
Bethel is such the Kuskokwim, the YK region, is a beautiful area, but so different topographically from other places that I visited. What were some of your first impressions getting there?
There were two seasons in Alaska, liquid and solid, that the Bethel area in particular was mostly liquid, except when it was solid. I loved being out on those endless winding waterways, and everything was new, everything was very exciting. It was adventuresome to bundle up in everything that I had and go out on the ice with a wind chill of 90 below and go, I'm alive.
Part of the things that you taught, cross-cultural studies, help me a little bit what cross-cultural means from an anthropologist's point of view.
So, cross-cultural is a bit misleading because it suggests that cultures are discrete things, that, you know, there's a culture here and a culture here, and you cross them. And in fact, culture is much slipperier, it's much more permeable, it's not bounded in those kinds of ways. But the cross-cultural communication program, which is what I was brought in by Ann Chinquin, to be part of, and Pat Kwatchka and Charlie Basham were the other two people who were involved in that at the time, was a very specific program that was for students coming to UAF who came from a background where they hadn't been exposed to the culture of the university. So it was the university culture that was really the focus, that was like thinking about the expectations of being a student and of negotiating all of the different aspects of getting an education, a higher education, as approaching a foreign culture.
Mm.
So using the tools of anthropology to help students succeed at UAF. That's really what that was about.
Back then, you were also interacting with the legal system and preparing, I'm assuming, people for what to experience in the court. Would that be right?
The legal system definitely has its own culture and its own implicit assumptions, which is really what culture is all about. We all bring these very implicit, unrecognized assumptions into our interactions, and they're shaped by the groups of people that we have grown up among. So initially, my involvement in legal interactions was in the Bethel area, where lawyers would say, maybe it would be a case that had to do with cultural adoption. And so as an anthropologist, it was like, well, I can explain to you how people think of their relatives, what kinship is about here. And understanding that's going to be really critical for people who are coming to the court to decide on this case. If you don't understand that, you don't understand why this child was fostered by these people rather than those people, for example. And what was expected in that relationship, and how that may affect a child's upbringing. And lawyers would also come with questions of motivation. They would have somebody maybe who was accused in a criminal case, and they would go, I don't understand why this person said what they did or didn't say anything. You know, and from an anthropological perspective, you can sort of think about why somebody might not have wanted to speak or might have spoken about something indirectly and give them some ideas, then they can then talk to their client.
Over time, from an outsider's perspective, Phyllis, it strikes me that the court system is more sensitive, more attuned to Alaska Native cultures. But that's from an outsider's point of view. What does it look like from an anthropologist's point of view?
On one level, I think the idea that culture is significant is there. But the idea of what culture is has not changed a whole lot. I mean, when I talk to lawyers, if I use the word, and that's not their fault, because it's more sort of the common understanding of culture. If I use the word culture, people are thinking, oh, you mean traditional stories, something like, and that's a very common one. And it's like, no, we're talking about someone's interpretation of what you're telling them they need to do and their sense of, might, for example, it might be the way this person was raised, they were taught that it's much better to say what you have done, to say, you know, I did this, and that paves the way for a reconciliation of some sort. In the legal system, and this has been true from my earliest experience working in the legal system, lawyers are puzzled by this because they figure that anybody who's ever watched any kind of a crime show knows that you don't fess up, you know, that that's the first thing you don't do. You talk to your lawyer, you find a way to tell your story or not tell your story, you make, you know, you learn what your options are, you know what your Miranda rights are, those kinds of things. But that has not changed very much. I think lawyers are not necessarily sensitive to that. The other issue is language, and that's something that's very near and dear to my heart, my approach. People still think that if someone is speaking English and the court is speaking English, yes, the people in the court are using a specialized sort of English, but everybody understands things more or less to the same degree and in the same ways. But the kind of English that one speaks is shaped by the language that they may have spoken, or that even if they didn't speak it, their families have spoken it, and this some of the cultural embedded assumptions in that language are coming across in their English. And the courts are much less sensitive to that. And of course, the cultural situations in the courts is so complex because it's not just Alaska Natives of different Alaska Native groups that appear in the courts. They're people from all different kinds of cultural backgrounds. So it's an enormously complex system.
Was it about 1987 that you came out to UAF from Western Alaska?
Yes.
I do want to ask you, as we know, the university is struggling with funding at the moment, and oftentimes people will say, you know, we should just jettison all our rural campuses. based on your experience, what do you say to people who say we can no longer afford these satellite campuses across Alaska?
The rural campuses have done something that Alaska struggled with for a very, very long time, or has struggled with for a very, very long time, which is to make education, higher education, available to people who live in remote communities. That's gone through so many iterations. There were a lot of distance delivery programs early on. They have ranged from correspondence courses mm-hmm. to traveling around to different villages to work with people. With the community college campuses, which then became colleges in their own right, you had the possibility of people like Mary Pete on the scene. You had someone who, you know, Mary was somebody who was educated at UAF. She was dedicated to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. She was extraordinarily bilingual, bicultural, highly educated. She was related to people. She knew everybody in the Delta. She knew what and was able to listen to people's requests for what they needed in that area. And the community colleges and the rural campuses have this unique ability to be physically located closer to the remote communities and to be responsive to local needs and to tailor programs for people in those areas that you just can't do from, you know, a more distant site.
Yeah.
And if we're looking at employment and we're looking at success in terms of thinking through the complexities of culture and life and options, you need that kind of education and you need it provided locally.
Okay.
The other thing to say is that those rural campuses, the infrastructure of these rural campuses, provide places for people to do all kinds of other things. I mean, just as within any small village in Alaska, whatever building is kind of a public building becomes a multi-purpose public building. It's where you have community celebrations. It's where you have meetings when there are important issues to be decided. It's where, you know, people have feasts. The community college campuses, the rural college campuses, I keep calling them community colleges because that's sort of evolutionarily how they where they were. But the rural campuses have those facilities where you can have, you know, the cultural festival or the important meetings or things going on in the libraries, and you can't do that remotely.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with anthropologist and former UAF dean Phyllis Morrow. When we return from the break, women's studies. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer, I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week, it's Phyllis Morrow, former dean and anthropologist. Let's get back to our conversation.
Okay, coming to UAF, who was in the department here when you arrived, Phyllis?
So Ann Shinkwin was dean, but she was still in the department. Linda Ilana, Jean Eigner, Roger Powers, Richard Scott, Lydia Black.
So it sounds like a robust and dynamic department.
It was a very robust department. And I kind of came in from the edge because Ann seated me in cross-cultural communications with a sort of a joint appointment in anthropology.
Well, one of the subjects that you also taught was women's studies. What were some of the issues that your students and you would discuss?
Well, we started the Women's Studies program. There wasn't a Women's Studies program when I first got to UAF, and Ann Shinkwin was very seminal in the development of women's studies. And I taught gender and cross-cultural perspective. So the contribution that that course made was to think about gender in terms of how people understand roles in other cultures and different times. And that's really critical because a lot of things that people say about gender are presumed to be universal. And unless you have a cross-cultural perspective, you're likely to go off with the, whatever assumptions you brought into the situation and not ever question them.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, more recently, the schools wrestled with some poor marks on Title IX. And were any of those issues raised in your classes, or were there concerns at that time, or how was that whole issue about safety on campus addressed? Do you recall anything like that?
Women's studies gave a place for women to talk to each other about all kinds of issues. So there were things that went on in the classroom in different kinds of classes. That particular topic was not something that I was teaching about, but it was certainly part of the whole kind of discussion that women's studies, that the faculty of women's studies had. You know, the way that you're talking about those issues now is very much the way they're being talked about at this time period.
At this time, sure.
Much less the way they were being talked about at that time period.
I'm sure, yeah. I mean,
there was much more sort of exploration of what's common about women's experiences, and what do we do about that commonality? What can be done about inequalities in work situations and in pay levels and assumptions about male roles and female roles as both dualistic and distinct in some ways? So a lot of the conversation was about those kinds of things. The women's studies programs basically allowed women who were experts in different disciplines to develop courses about specifically about women in the light of those disciplines. So women's history and the history of the women's movement. So anthropology, culture, gender and cross-cultural perspective, sociology of gender, all of these different areas that people were involved in, and women in science. So when the faculty were rapidly developing courses in their own area of expertise, or related to their own area of expertise, but with a focus on gender or women's studies.
Mm-hmm. Before we take you to leadership and administration, you went over to the UK and studied at Cambridge. You were a visiting scholar there. That must have been exciting. What precisely were you looking at when you went over there?
So that was a sabbatical year, and it was an opportunity to write up some of the work that I had been doing in legal anthropology at the time. But it was just a very interesting place to be. I was both connected with one of the colleges at Cambridge and also with the Scott Polar Research Institute. And that was interesting because Cambridge is really heady. I mean, it's very rarefied. It's very detailed disciplinary studies. Lots to learn from them. I sought out the people who were doing various legally related, and I said it was very heady, but there was this other branch, the Scott Polar Research Institute, which was much more grounded. And the Scott Polar Research Institute attracted people from around the North, actually, who were studying all kinds of things. I mean, it ranged from a Sami student who was concerned about suicide rates in his area, people who were doing bilingual education, but all kinds of subjects that people were interested in relation to the North. And they were much more connected to communities and places than a lot of the other Cambridge faculty. So it was kind of a nice balance of those two things. It gave me an opportunity to spend a lot of time thinking about theory in the library, and a lot of time working with people who are doing stuff in the North that were involved with real people in real situations.
Now, bringing you back to UAF, it wasn't long after that return that your work in administration as department head and then various positions following. Was there an aha moment on that front for you, Phyllis, that you realized this wasn't a burden, but actually something you were good at?
That's a really interesting question. And I was director of the Yupik Language Center, which was small. So that was the first administrative position that I was in.
That was in Bethel.
That was in Bethel. And when I did administration, I carried it like a very heavy weight. You know, I would go home and angst about things. Mm. I did find I matured a lot in a role as an administrator because I did find that I had some fortes, and some of them involved the ability to get people to talk to each other and respect each other and come to some kinds of agreements. And then, you know, I could run meetings. I was good at running meetings, and you spend a lot of time running meetings. And I also was good at understanding that there's always more than one side of a story. When I had just become dean, I visited with somebody else who was a dean back east. And I said, "You have any words of wisdom? What's the job like?" And she said, imagine that your office is full of monkeys, and they're swinging all around, and they're bouncing off, and they're throwing all the books. And she said, and every 5 minutes, somebody opens the door and throws another monkey in. That's being a dean. And the truth to that is that generally issues don't make it to the dean's office unless they can't be resolved by faculty at another level. And so essentially they are contentious, and somebody's going to be unhappy with whatever decision gets made. And often whatever decision gets made is not going to be able to be, you know, permanent. So the trick is to try and make it more longstanding, to weigh in when you need to weigh in, and to know when not to weigh in, to bring in other people who know something about the situation and listen to them and, you know, recruit their skills.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. I'm talking this episode with Phyllis Morrow, who was dean at a time at UAF when they reshuffled departments at the university. When we return from the break, the value of liberal arts. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week I'm speaking with anthropologist and former dean Phyllis Morrow. Let's get back to the conversation.
Well, during this time, there were certain repositioning of schools and colleges and whatnot. On the liberal arts side of things, did you have a vision about what the ideal university looked like structurally?
So I will say that the College of Liberal Arts, when I came in, it certainly was the most diverse college on campus. I just went back and looked at my file that said CLA Dean, and I had a subfile that said departments and programs. And at the time I came in, we had everything. You know, we obviously had the arts, the humanities, the social sciences, the behavioral sciences, but we had KUAC, and we had the library, and we had cross-cultural studies, and we had Northern studies.
Well, you know, it seems to me, again, as an outsider, people don't respect the liberal arts. It's sort of like, well, that's great for the ivory tower, but this is real life.
This question came up so much, and I was always speaking about it, and it seemed that what I was saying in 2005 was so just equally relevant now. So I'm just a couple of paragraphs. Basically, I'd been talking about the liberal arts and creativity being one arm of the liberal arts and the importance of creativity in life. But I said, if one arm of the liberal arts is creativity, the other is conscience. Plato said that the unexamined life is not worth living. Equally, the unexamined economy is less economically viable. Unexamined history is, of course, doomed to be repeated. Unexamined social policies are likely to disproportionately harm some members of society. Unexamined scientific research has unintended social consequences. you name it, if we don't take a hard look at it, if we don't hold it up against conscientious scholarship, we're in deep trouble. What's unique about the liberal arts tradition of inquiry is that we use the history of thought to imagine the consequences of the present. The liberal arts bring to bear on any topic the history of several thousand years of disciplined reflection about related topics. And that's true of the arts as well as the humanities and social sciences. The arts present that history of thinking in a visceral form, often with more impact. We have a responsibility, I think, in the liberal arts to articulate reasoned, compassionate, and passionate perspectives to challenge and to champion things. On the face of it, studying Dickens seems like it's less critical to building a sustainable future than cold climate housing research. But people who thought about 19th century social conditions, not to mention those who studied Alaska Native architecture, are likely to make better engineers. Because when designing habitations, they're going to take things into account that you don't learn in engineering courses. And those are the things that you learn in the liberal arts.
Yeah. Well, you really extend that philosophy into your life. Since you retired, you and Chase now consult. You also lead a writers group in FCC. So talk to me a little bit about life after the academy.
You know, I feel like life after the academy is the mature version of life way before the academy. Because when I was growing up, I was interested in all of these things. And my parents always supported them. So I was very into drama and music and art and travel and, you know, all of those kinds of things. So being able to come back to that now, but with a different set of experiences behind it and different ways to enjoy it and somebody wonderful to enjoy it with is a real pleasure.
Well, I think it's important too. I'm guessing, and I'm just going to theorize here, for your work in Fairbanks Correctional Center, giving voice to people who may not have had anybody ask them to reflect on their experience is tremendously important, and it underscores what you just said about the liberal arts.
Well, let me first say there's a number of us who are doing this. It's kind of a rotating group of people who are going in there, Sarah Stanley. And I don't think we give anybody a voice. I think those voices are loud and clear. We're creating some contexts in which the women who come to the writers' workshop can voice themselves to each other, and one of the things that we're really trying to facilitate is to get that out in some way. So we have a blog, you can read it, it's called Voices Uncaged, and those women who've written something that they would like to get out there, just give it to us, we type it up, and it goes on the blog. Very powerful things. It's also just a space away from the really difficult conditions that people are experiencing in the dorms, where they don't have a moment of peace, where people can stop and think and talk to each other, and they give each other a lot of mutual support, and they have a lot of very profound things to say about both their experience and about whatever topic we may have brought in, which sometimes drives the conversation and sometimes is completely set aside because there's something else that's more pressing that people want to talk about.
So I always give an opportunity for people in the audience to ask some questions. So your life with music.
My life with music. I started playing the clarinet when I was in fourth grade. I was really into it and then became less and less into it because I was doing other things. When I retired, Charlie Basham said to me, "What do you want to do in retirement?" And I sort of almost whispered to her, I said, "You know, I'd really like to pick up my clarinet again. It'd been 40 years." And she said, "Well, what would you like to play?" And I said, "Secretly, I'd like to play klezmer music." And she said, "Well, there's a klezmer group in town." And I said, "Forget that." But she called them up, and I got an invitation. And they said, "We have a very low standard. One right note per measure." And I said, "I might be able to do that." and it kind of went from there, and that's been 10 years, and it's a thriving group, and we have a whole lot of fun. And I get to sing with the group, too. The music is lovely, and being able to do it in retirement where I'm not trying to do it for anything. You know, one of the lovely things about retirement is all the stakes are low. Just like in childhood, you can fail miserably, and it's okay. And so I encourage everybody to use your retirement to do some of those things that you love that you were afraid you would fail at, as well as not having enough time for. Fail. It's good. It's a good experience. It's okay. There's no, you've already done all that stuff that you couldn't fail at.
Well, let's hear it for Phyllis Morrow. Thank you so much.
Links to Phyllis Morrow's site and summer sessions are on the Northern Soundings website. My thanks to Michelle Bartlett and Summer Sessions for permission to air the discussion. When we return from the break, Chris Lott is in to look at 3Ds. Some letters, it seems, come in threes. There are, of course, the three R's of pedagogy, and as Chris Lott explains, our state of the state has produced 3Ds.
As we approach the denouement of the debacle that is Alaska's political season this year, I'm left with far too much time to contemplate our dystopic future. And since I've already spoken here about the first word that constantly comes to mind of late, demagogue, today features a trio of other D words that typify the time and some of its cast of characters. Let's start with one of the words most commonly and reasonably being thrown around in Alaska right now, dunce. Now used to refer to adult, or at its most charitable, a radically slow learner, dunce originated as an eponym for followers of the great Scottish thinker John Duns Scotus, thus ending speculation that the word dunce and Alaska's governor's family name have an etymological connection. Followers of Duns Scotus at least had good reason for their admiration. Scotus was a justly admired philosopher and theologian who, among other things, explained in a way fundamental to much of Christianity today the idea of the Immaculate Conception, logically demonstrating how Mary could both conceive without sin and, like all flawed human beings, need redemption too. The Scotists, often called Duns disciples or Duns men, don't at me about the gendering, this was the late 13th century, held sway until the Reformation, when their kind of tedious logical justification, or hair-splitting if that's how you roll, fell out of favor, not least because none were masters of the philosophical subtleties as Scotus was. Capital D Duns became minuscule D Duns as it was more generally applied, first to those who were too fond of book learning and without what the reigning humanists considered insight, such as when John Lyly wrote in 1578 that if one be hard in conceiving, they pronounce him adult, if given to study, they proclaim him a Duns. And then to the slow-witted more generally, as when Francis Thynne recorded in the Holinshed Chronicles in 1587, that now in our age it has grown to be a common proverb and derision, to call such a person as is senseless or without learning a dunce, which is as much as a fool. But it might be Ambrose Bierce who captured the contemporary meaning of dunce best in his Devil's Dictionary entry for the synonymous dullards, when he wrote, "The secret of their power is their insensibility to blows. Tickle them with a bludgeon, and they laugh with a platitude." If this daymare brought on by a group that, when not fleeing their duties, assembles merely to dissemble, makes your days feel dismal, you are right, both in principle, kudos to you for differentiating yourself from them by having some, and etymologically. Dismal originated as a noun, the dismal, referring to days of misfortune, which came from the old French phrase de mal, bad days, which came from the Latin dies mali, evil days. These days, two of them for each month, were literally marked on calendars as unlucky days, and were also known as Dies Aegypticae, the Egyptian days, because they were supposedly first calculated by Egyptian astronomers. Starting in the late 16th century, and certainly in this political season, Dismal's extended sense as a reference to things which cause dejection or depression is on constant display. And I'd submit that another of Dismal's meanings, as a noun to describe tracts of literally swampy land, is due for a metaphorical revival. As Christopher Hitchens was said to have said, though I've had no luck tracking down the source, how dismal it is to see present-day Americans yearning for the very orthodoxy that their country was founded to escape. Another word used to describe those original dismal days is the oddly euphonious word disaster, which despite its similarly dark meaning shares no roots with dismal. Disaster wended its way to us from the Italian disastro, which literally means ill-starred, the dis prefix being used here much like the English mis prefix is, to indicate something negative, as in words we must have constantly at the ready right now, including mistaken, misleading, misguided, misinformed, and misbegotten. Plus the familiar astro from the Latin for star, though you would be forgiven for wondering if the astro as applied in contemporary times would be better spelled with two S's. As you might surmise from its history, disaster, though of different beginnings than dismal, was similarly born of astrological concerns. Those ill-starred days were literally so, based on divination not that much different in kind from the dogmatic frothing that is increasingly a favorite of prognosticating politicians. Incidentally, you might also consider the word consider itself. Consider is similarly rooted in astrology, likely coming from considerare, to look closely at something, which is formed from the Latin sidera, or stars. So to consider something was, and should be, to treat it with the attention and reverence you would when ruminating on the stars. Not that such consideration means much in Alaska right now, where the political firmament rests just 6'7" plus a limp gray would-be pompadour off the ground. Life sometimes eclipses satire in funny ways, funny odd, not funny haha, which makes Christopher Buckley's satirical 2008 novel Supreme Courtship feel prescient for all kinds of reasons. If you can stomach that kind of thing right now, I recommend it. But it's Buckley's timeless observation about arrogant ineptitude that strikes and is too often found closest to home. How many times, Buckley asks, have those awful words, "I know what I'm doing," been uttered throughout history as a prelude to disaster? If this 3D exploration hasn't left you delirious with doom, you can refresh your knowledge of demagoguery, find out the truth about the origin of the dunce cap, perhaps a more fitting identifier in these times than a badge of political affiliation, and learn about a few words ripe for resurrection right now, including dastard and dabsters, by directing your favorite browser to katexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We'll see you next week when I talk with marine scientist and author Ron Smith. Thanks for listening.